All right, we're back. Channel 9 Live in TechEd Europe. It's 2012, I believe. And this is going to be a security panel, calling it Security for Hackers. And I kind of wanted to talk about, you know, the different definitions of hacker. We're with two very special guests, Paula.
Januszkiewicz, yes.
Okay. And Andy Malone. That's easy. Malone's easy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, you both are, you know, security experts. I know that you're a penetration tester.
Yes.
You have a company. You really help out. Microsoft, thank you for the work that you do in other companies.
Thank you.
Andy, what about you? What's your specialty?
I do a lot of trainings, consultings. My particular areas of interest are forensics and social engineering, social networking.
Excellent. So one of the questions I want to get off like right now, since it's timely, that is cyber warfare and what we're seeing with both super highly sophisticated attacks like Stuxnet, and then less sophisticated, though very powerful, attacks like Flame. Can we talk a little about what you guys are seeing out in the real world and what's going on here?
Yeah, definitely. So if I could start.
Yes.
We do have Stuxnet, Deku, Flame, and so on. So like a couple of years ago, we had a situation in which all the threats were like super minimal. So they were targeted mostly to companies, users. They had something to do with the finance, right? Mm-hmm. So the most important thing was the information gathering. Nowadays, we are actually attacking people. So Stuxnet was targeted to Iranian nuclear centrifuges. So that's something that is really dangerous for human beings.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, and so,
I was going to say the same thing, that in the past it was all about, you know, the bad guys getting money from people. And, you know, that is still a big area. Mm-hmm. But obviously it's now all about governments and, you know, cyber warfare is a way of avoiding potentially real warfare.
Yes.
So there is an argument that it actually will and does save lives.
Especially the thing that is really interesting, that all this code was available a couple of years ago. Flame is not new, Stuxnet was not new, but it was
really
accidentally discovered because of the, I would say, vulnerability in the code.
Okay.
So that's why we were able to see what is in the code, because Stuxnet was actually going wild.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine the situation where we actually do not know what is happening in Iran and centrifuges,
yes,
and the Stuxnet is doing its own job.
Yes.
So it was just by accident, but luckily for us, we know what is happening right now.
Interesting. But that kind of leads to a question of, I mean, if you have 500 million lines of code, 500 million lines of code that has direct access to hardware that runs in kernel mode in some components, pieces of it.
With the stolen certificates.
With stolen certificates. I mean, in some sense, is there such a thing as absolute protection?
Well,
I mean, can you really write perfect systems of 500 million lines of code?
Well, I would say no, because Stuxnet used 4 zero-day vulnerabilities. So somebody really smart was working on it.
Yes.
And usually it's not a one person.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's like a group of people. So, you know, operating system, it's also a piece of code.
Yes.
So it's just a matter of how much can you exploit it, how smart you are, how deep can you go, and so on. And if you have like a smart group of people and they're especially working on it, then I will say no.
Okay.
And the question is, you know, those digital certificates that were stolen, were they stolen or were they obtained coercely?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so.
That's an interesting question. I mean,
yeah.
But I think it is important to understand. I think not everybody out in the audience will know essentially what Stuxnet is. You mentioned four zero-day vulnerabilities. Zero-day vulnerabilities are the worst kind.
Yeah.
Which means they're immediately exploitable.
Definitely.
Can you tell people out in the audience, give us a little rundown of what is Stuxnet and what is Flame? How do they work?
That's your area.
Yeah, okay. So, well, the difference between Stuxnet and Flame and Deku, let's mention Deku, because
Deku
is a newer version of Stuxnet.
Okay.
Not directly, but pretty much similar. So if it's about the Stuxnet, this was a piece of code that was targeted to Iranian centrifuges.
Mm-hmm.
Well, mainly because the code was written in a way that is really factory specific. So if you have centrifuges that are, let's say, in the rows, and you have 15 rows, and there are several number of centrifuges, and you call directly that numbers in a code. The question is, who was writing it?
Yes.
So this was the Stuxnet case, and it's not a political discussion. It's more like a security panel. So let me say it. But this.
Trying to be politically correct.
Yeah, exactly. A couple of years ago, United States was struggling with the nuclear technologies and so on, so making the long story short. And the idea, and this is what many people say, of course you do not have the official confirmation for Stuxnet, was to a little bit slow down Iranian development of the nuclear power plants.
Sure.
So this is what Stuxnet was about. And if it's about the flame, that's super interesting.
Yes.
It's more like an espionage solution.
Yeah.
If the flame was used to wipe, I would say wipe at the end, but first get information from, in most cases, Iranian governmental people, and just keep it for a reference. And the best thing about the flame was that it had its own kill command, which is if you like say, I want to wipe this computer and wipe everything that is on it, then you can just do this.
Wow.
And Syria, Lebanon, Sudan, Iran, and so on, and Hungary, surprisingly, these were the flame's target.
Wow. Interesting.
Yeah.
Now, let me ask this, though. I mean, in some sense, it's certainly the case that if you put enough intellectual horsepower behind any sort of hack, Now, I don't know. This is an interesting point. I mean, there's hacking and what I would call like dark side hacking or Sith hacking, to use Star Wars terminology. Yeah. Then there's Jedi hacking, which is the stuff that like, you know, good people do to either protect other people, like what you guys do, or just who actually write the software and design the systems as secure as possible.
Yeah.
What about the fact that you could have vulnerabilities that are undetectable? And that the best type of dark side hacking would be you wouldn't get discovered because you'd really understand to such a degree that no one would be able to see sort of what the rootkit idea was, but a little more extreme than that. Do you think that's possible? Is it something that worries you or concerns you?
You mean like unpatched vulnerabilities or the ones that nobody knows but their use?
So, Stuxnet or Flame was probably in the wild for a while.
Yes.
Before people figured it out.
Yeah.
But they figured it out.
By accident.
By accident only.
Because of the Stuxnet was read in a way to go wild.
An interesting point.
Interesting.
I mean, how do you look back at Stuxnet and go, you know, a lot of the governments are standing up now. The US government stood up and said, yeah, okay, we did it. It was ours. It's in the papers. It's live. And I think people step back from that now and they go, okay, yeah, it did save lives. So maybe it was a good thing. Maybe they understand it. Because, I mean, let's face it, the majority of Stuxnet and those types of attacks don't affect kind of normal people and normal people's equipment.
Well, flame effects.
Yes, flame, yes.
But they could, right? I mean, they could
absolutely.
They could be in my personal system, they could be hard to detect, hard to discover, stealing my password, stealing my bank account, making transactions. I mean, there was just in the paper yesterday, $78 million was stolen from a bank because hackers were doing some pretty sophisticated stuff. I want to get to a question from the real important question askers. This is McCremple. Can't you prevent rogue programs from running code randomly by some kind of contract?
Contract?
Well, I guess in some sense, if you said no kernel, no untrusted kernel code can run, that's a contract. But I don't know. What kind of contracts do you mean, McCremple?
Yeah, it'll be great to explain that.
Yeah, go ahead and ask your question again.
Well, for now, I would say, like, based on the question that we do have 64-bit operating system, and anything that it's running in a kernel mode must be signed.
Yes.
So it's not a matter of 64 bits. It's a matter of just another version of the operating system that requires in the kernel mode for stuff to be signed. So that's some kind of protection for that kind of code. But if you steal the certificates and if you manage to sign your own drivers, and the certificates, it's not on serialless, like it was in a case of Stuxnet, and a little bit similar case was in Flame. Then, what can I say? Then we are waiting for CRL.
Absolutely.
I think it's more about the, I was speaking with Paul about this, the fabric of society's changing as well. The idea of hackers just hacking PCs to make money, it's now about hacking infrastructure. And for the government, it's about defending that infrastructure against cyber terrorism. And that's why many national security agencies are now training cyber soldiers. To either
cyber soldiers.
Cyber soldiers. There's courses.
But
in
we need those super IQ developers to come work for Microsoft, man.
Just, I'm kidding. I mean, these must be super skilled people. Let me ask you this. You know, must have a sense in your mind that how shall I say this? Not the morphology, but the personality of one of these hackers. What drives somebody in your mind to try to break into the system and do bad things versus just try to break into the system and see if you can do it? Do you have any sort of psychology around these types?
I think a lot of it's money. Obviously, money. Money. That's the number one reason.
I would say number one reason is passion.
Passion.
I know, it sounds pretty cheap, but if you're not passionate about what you're doing, then you will just do the things that hackers are doing. And money is going to be the first, the second thing here, right? Yeah. I'm passionable, I know the stuff, so... Well, let's use it in some kind of beneficial way.
Okay, excellent.
Yeah.
So McCremple is now redefining his question. Okay, manage who gets to call what instead of letting everybody call everything. So a contract between caller and provider. He's talking about, I guess, the method level of code.
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. That's definitely a good question about the architecture. So if we are talking about this kind of stuff, this is the change that is on the architecture layer. Mm-hmm. And well, for now, in a kernel mode, kernel, it's, you know, really written in a very positive way, really good way. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to say it wasn't changed for a while, because it's definitely not true. Mm-hmm. But the core of the kernel, it's remains unchanged really for a while, and it's working in a very, very smart way. So answering the question, it's an architecture case, and that's something that I would say we'll need to sit and discuss it as an idea, not just like solution out of box when we are sitting here.
Sure. And I mean, I guess when he's using the term contract, it's sort of the contract-oriented programming where you can have, like in languages like Eiffel, where you can say, you know, you do a test case to see if this is going to output 2 or whatever, then you can continue running the function.
Yeah,
if
like
not, it's not really going to be make any sense, blah, blah, blah. In his case, he's talking about, could you say only a trusted caller could call this method?
Hmm.
What does a trusted caller mean, and what does that mean? I understand what you're saying. It would be an architectural...
architecture design problem
absolutely.
In this case, yeah.
So now, Paula, you do a lot of penetration testing. I'm sure you've done a lot of reading in this area. What are some of the modern sort of problems you're seeing? I mean... Nothing's 100% locked down. Are there any like things that make you go, wow, that's an interesting exploit?
Social engineering. That's something that always works.
Okay.
Yeah. My last project in US was about social engineering, actually. Mm. So I was actually going to people and handing them the USB stick and asking them politely if they could do something for me.
Oh, my goodness.
And they were doing this.
And free CDs goes a long way.
The best thing was that they had actually a USC window in front of them, and I said like, oh, don't worry, just click on it. And they were like, okay. And
oh my
it works.
Goodness.
So
yeah.
Social engineering education, that's the first thing.
Mm-hmm.
And in the vast majority of cases, it's a matter of misconfiguration.
Okay, misconfiguration.
Yes. Because operating system, when we are discussing the Microsoft technologies, they're very secure. The ideas are great, and I really love all the internals in the operating systems, and they are working. But if you misconfigure them, then you expose yourself to really vulnerable situations.
Absolutely.
I think the biggest weakness is the assumption that you're secure. You assume automatically that just because you go onto the internet and you do online banking, you are secure. So I think that is very much a weakness. And also the liability of many software manufacturers. I know that many producers of software are having to relook back at their legal agreements now because obviously there was a read a case recently where the software, it was a small company, they produced an accounting software and they were hacked, and the actual customer sued the company because they told it, they said it was totally secure.
Interesting. So note to self, don't tell people that.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, in some sense, you know, as we jump into a world where it's easier to do more computation in a fixed amount of time, say target a GPU and blast through trying to do what people do. They try to force whatever it's called, like you're forcing. Yeah.
Whatever some, technology you have.
Exactly. And you're trying to figure out passwords, but you can do it super fast on the GPU, for example. I mean, it seems like a cat and mouse.
There's a different method. Sorry to interrupt you.
It's a what?
It's a different method right now.
Okay.
There's a new thing that popped up a couple of, I would say months, well, weeks, couple of weeks ago. Yeah. There is a function in LSA, which is to unprotect the stuff that LSA keeps in the memory. And you don't need to crack and use GPU and so on and waste your time. Yeah. It just comes to you.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. All right, I'm unplugging from the internet. We have a question from RD3D. There is still an underground cool vibe to hacking. What, if anything, can be done to change this?
I think there's two sides to the, I mean, you're talking about the groups like Anonymous. A lot of people join those types of groups to be cool, to be, you know, it's socially, you know, you're going against the grain type scenario. But then there's another side of that group that actually want to do a lot of serious damage. Mm-hmm. So I think before joining groups like that or getting involved with groups like that, you would have to really question, you know, what are you going to get out of it? Because, you know, if you're doing bad stuff, you're going to get caught eventually. So, you know, you got to be very careful.
I would say that as long as it's like based on passion and the research and cracking stuff just for your pleasure, that's totally fine. But when it gets to human, then it's definitely not fine. And if we are talking about this, you know, underground hacking, I'm not sure. What actually do we mean? We mean like a group that are actually criminals, or just groups that are, you know, hiding in a pavement and doing their own job? So what is an underground hacking? Hacking is always about breaking things, right?
True.
So hacking is just whatever. It's a white hacking, black hacking, underground hacking.
Well, I mean,
it's
about,
doesn't matter.
It's about writing code, man.
Yes,
it's about, it's about
code,
solving problems.
And solving problems, cracking things.
Totally.
Yeah, so.
And you can be a good person and do that. I mean, Mark Rusinovich was hired because he cracked into the NT and figured out how it worked. We said, come on in, man.
I still use his tool.
Right on.
The tool is called GP Disable.
And making your products more secure.
This is a tool that is not available on system journals.
Nice.
Yeah.
So we have another question. If a professional wants to hack you, are you done for? Is there anything a non-professional can do to protect themselves? So if somebody who has the capability to invent exploits like Stuxnet, these are going to be scientists and ultra-skilled coders. If they target you because maybe they don't like you, are you done for? That's his question.
There's things that you can do to protect yourself. You can, you know, you can follow all the best advice and do whatever you can do. Ultimately, encryption is the best kind of defense at the end of the day. But is there an ultimate defense? I don't think technically, I don't think we're there yet. So I would probably say no. There's no defense.
Yeah, the same answer comes from me. I would say no.
Okay.
Because there are many things that if it's about non-professional users that maybe they just do not understand, and they don't need to understand it. So they will just, you know, click in several places just by accident, or somebody is going to use the vulnerability that is just discovered. So definitely no.
Okay. Now, whatever happened to the green box, red box concept, where you could basically say this computer or this session, I don't care what goes on here because I know that the code can't run beneath this abstraction layer, or at least I hope. That's my theory, this protection layer. The other machine is something that I keep pristine and pure. Maybe I never connected to the network, which should make it kind of useless. But let's pretend like it was still useful. What was wrong with that model, and why wasn't that sort of adopted? And has that been adopted in modern operating systems as far as user mode protection?
I would say it was adapted not because of the security idea, but because of the management issues.
Okay.
So it's way easier to manage things that, for example, are virtualized rather than having the computer that, you know, every software that you install leaves its own footprint. There is a lot of this kind of software that are cleaning out your registry and so on. What for?
Okay.
So I would say the security thing here goes as a second point. Okay. The first point is how to manage this.
Makes sense.
I think there's a lot of great features in products like Windows. I mean, you've got BitLocker, you've got EFS, you've got IPsec encryption, but it's all optional. Mm. You know, it's all optional. We all use it optionally. I think the day should come when just switch it all on. I think life would be a lot more secure.
Sure. So, the recent LinkedIn, the unsalted MD5 hash, leads into this next question. What is the best encryption algorithm application that you suggest? Huh. Do you have a favorite or think it's the...
I would say as long as it's working, it's good.
Okay,
so
fair enough.
I know, it sounds really obvious, but as long as it's working, it's good. If it's about the LinkedIn, I would like to add one thing on the top of it.
Please do.
So I'm a huge fan of LinkedIn because whenever you're using HTTPS, they do not encrypt password in the channel.
Okay.
I mean, it should be done while... at this level of the portal and so many people are there, whenever you do have an HTTPS inspection in a company, let's say you are traveling, you've got this sometimes in a hotel. If somebody is sniffing inside the channel, so this person is like man in the middle, and the user is actually establishing a connection with the hotel and hotel with the LinkedIn, then you can listen to the user's password in a clear text. And the question is the user using the same password within the organization? If not, do you add a number at the end? I mean, like, you know,
exactly.
The password 12345 and so on. And with every month, every time you need to change it.
Huh.
So I would say that's a shame.
Absolutely.
I kind of feel, though, that we're coming near the end of the password, the whole password era. I think people are becoming much more aware of the dangers of using usernames and passwords. And I mean, even products like Windows 8 with its picture IDs and smart cards, I think they're becoming so much more adopted now. And that adds a much stronger layer of identifying users, you know?
Or protection, at least where you can feel safe.
Absolutely.
Because, I mean, if code is executing, and a lot of it is executing, and you have a port open on your computer, it's code.
Yeah.
And
by definition, it's exploitable.
The browser is the key.
Yeah. I mean, we're running technology, but the underlying infrastructure of that technology hasn't changed in years.
Yeah.
You know, so whatever we're writing on top of that.
It.
So, you know, that's the underneath needs to change.
Excellent. All right. So it's great to see lots of questions coming in. I guess people in New York are awake now, and people in Amsterdam are still sleeping, but I understand why, and that's totally cool. All right. How safe is the average user using correctly configured MS Security Essentials on Win7 versus a commercial antivirus package?
So, well, it's a Microsoft conference. What else can we say?
You can say whatever you want.
I know. I'm an independent,
Understood.
Independent consultant. So I'm actually sincerely a fan of Microsoft solutions, antivirus solutions.
Okay.
Because their engines are based on the top engines that I use on the market. I don't want to mention companies, but really the top ones.
Okay.
So Microsoft, it's not like, you know, totally independent company that builds on their own engine and they're doing their own scanning. Mm-hmm. But Microsoft Symantec, Kaspersky, and so on, they work with each other.
Sure.
So if there is something that pop ups, like the Stuxnet case or Flame Dooku that we've mentioned, mm-hmm. then everybody's going to have the signature. So the question is, with what kind of solution do you feel positively?
Yes.
Do you feel that it slows down the operating system, whatever it means, then mm-hmm. use something else. I like Microsoft solutions because mm-hmm. they were written by people that really understand what is going inside Windows.
Exactly.
And I really appreciate that knowledge.
Now, that said, I'd only say it to people at other companies as well. These are also kernel-type developers because most of the code they're writing is running at the lowest level. They're writing C, right? They're
running C code. Remember that
Security
Essentials, great for home users. Absolutely fantastic for home users. Small businesses, great. But if you want something for more of an enterprise product, you want to start looking beyond that, I would say.
Sure. Now, one of the big things we've been talking about, at, I guess for the past 2 years now, is this cloud thing, right? The cloud. The cloud is also an operating system. Again, Mark couldn't make it, but we've had many conversations with him. You both know him quite well. So we have Windows, Azure, an operating system in the cloud, right? So does that worry you at all, or does it give you more opportunity to think through, like, how can I make a Stuxnet for Windows, Azure?
Yeah, that's a scary vision, right? The thing is that the Azure, it's brand new technology, so it still needs to be discovered by people that has something to do with security. Mm-hmm. So that's gonna take time before we're gonna, you know, hear about stuff if they even appear.
Yeah.
The thing that struggles me is that whenever you build up the application and you move application, for example, from your regular premises to the cloud, when you just, you know, take it like it is and put it in the cloud, you'll bring all the problems that were internally available with application to the cloud. For example, whenever the application requires logging in, and there is a huge chance because applications are personalized, what is the chance that somebody won't like to hack it over the internet? You know, you can try the username and password and so on so many times. You may have your own policies and so on, but you just take this problem with authentication and put it in the cloud. Mm. So it's not that easy to move to the cloud. And of course, it brings a lot of security issues over here, but if we understand the cloud, how it works and so on, we can cope with this. It's just another technology.
Sure.
I do a lot of training in terms of cloud computing as well. One of the issues about encrypting data in the cloud is, you can imagine that if everybody was encrypting their data in the cloud, it would probably bring the data centers down.
Because of computation.
Exactly. The actual work that's involved in it mathematically.
Yeah.
So there is now a new market that's starting to emerge, encrypting the data before it gets to the cloud. So already it's already encrypted in the cloud. Okay. And we're seeing an awful lot of new companies, both free and also, you know, commercial product offerings for that. That's quite interesting.
I love the next question.
Let's do it. Which one? The top one?
The top one.
All right. So what are the top tools you keep in your security toolbox?
Do we have like 3 hours, by the way?
Yeah, we have about 20 minutes maybe.
Okay.
So what are the top three?
Like,
is that clear?
Fiddler.
That's top two?
Tough. Okay. Let's keep it with top two.
Okay.
For me,
yeah.
I like very much for testing the web applications, Akunetics. I really believe in the guy's idea, and they're really smart Russians, Brazilians, and so on. So they're writing the code, and it's really working. I know it's an automated tool. I mean, you really need to do things manually, but this is a tool that really helps out to do the penetration testing if it's about applications.
Excellent.
And the second one, because I do have only two options you gave me.
Well, you can do three or four. It's up to you.
Okay.
It's dynamic.
So the second one's going to be your own tool that you write for the specific purpose.
Okay.
And if you feel like you would like to discover something and do the deep dive, the best tool is your own tool.
Right on.
Yes. So to get information about some issues running in the network. And the third tool, I would say, and that's pretty obvious, but it really helps a lot. Wireshark or Microsoft Network Monitor. Mm-hmm. So all the monitoring tools that are running over the network, because these are the tools, and usually things are going through the network, these are the tools that are going to answer to a lot of questions.
Absolutely. And of course, sysinternals tools.
Oh, I'm not even mentioning this.
Yeah.
Yeah, three options, I said. Do you have three
hours?
You
have four options. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
You stole my options. I was going to...
You have to do different ones, man.
I was going to say... probably TrueCrypt is a great security product, and Network Monitor, fabulous product. Wireshark, great product, as she said.
And the third one.
What was the other one we were using?
Metasploit.
Metasploit.
Oh, yeah. Nmap as well. That's a good one.
Excellent. Now, let's talk about that. I mean, how does Metasploit work?
Metasploit is a database of exploits that you can play on the operating system.
Okay.
Not only, of course, about on many solutions, many products, including Microsoft products. Mm-hmm. And whenever there is a new vulnerability that is discovered, people sit and write and exploit, so that whenever you are doing the penetration test and you go to a company, you can check out if the company is up to date Like, let's say there were some things that happened 1 week ago. You jump in, you test it out, and it's like, you're not touching your operating systems.
Interesting.
Because it's working. The last thing was RDP vulnerability. Pretty interesting. Really, I would say, super solution for administrator. They were really happy when this was happening.
Great.
Because it causes a blue screen. So nothing more funnier.
Yes.
And when it's working, when you're doing the penetration test, and you can do it digitally, you know, whenever you enter the building, you can use this vulnerability. Well, what can I say? It's super useful.
Cool. I would add one tool, Passware Forensic. Absolutely great tool.
Password Forensic?
Passware Forensic.
Interesting.
Absolutely great tool.
So, I mean, I guess we get this other question here. It's been up there for a little while. Will adoption of UEFI BIOS the new in Windows 8, Windows 7, features in the new secure boot OS reduce exploits?
I think it's a good idea. I like it. I mean, it's good for the vendors, obviously, because it locks down their systems. Not so good if you want to put Linux on it or a different operating system or dual boot, but I think there is a specific market for it. I don't know how widely adopted it's going to be enforced, but I like the principle of it.
Yeah, I think, well, if you want to work on some exploit and you try harder, then this will help out here, but definitely it's going to be a reduction of the exploits. Yeah,
sure.
That's the idea.
Excellent. So, more questions coming in. This is great. CH9 Live, tweet questions in. What encryption do you use on your systems? Somebody really wants to know what your favorite encryption algorithm is. So, what encryption do you use on your own personal?
BitLocker.
BitLocker?
Yes.
Okay.
BitLocker AES-256 encryption.
Okay, excellent. Now let's go back to the LinkedIn thing and talk a little bit about MD5 hash unsalted. Explain to people why that's a bad idea or what does it mean? How's that? Let's start there.
Repeat the question.
So the vulnerability in LinkedIn was that they were using MD5 hash, which
yes.
is fine,
yep.
But it's unsalted.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I just wanted people out there to understand what that means and why. Was that a bad idea, or was there...
To leave it unsalted?
Yes.
Well, yes.
Of course.
Yes, of course.
But what does that mean for people who don't know what that... They didn't put salt on it.
Yeah, so salt, technically speaking, or maybe not less technically speaking, it's using a key, additional key, that is encrypting additionally data that we have over here, and the hash cannot exist without the salt, so you were not able to decrypt is not a proper word. Revert it.
Okay.
So whenever we are using the operating system password, we are also using the salt, which means we are adding some complication so that we cannot get the password from the a string that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's about the LinkedIn case, well, what can I say?
Pretty impressive that they figured that out.
Yeah.
I mean, how did they? Let me ask you that. How does somebody go about figuring out that LinkedIn is using an MD5 hash that's not salted? So in other words, how do you figure that out as a hacker?
Actually,
any ideas?
No. I don't know how they've done it. So.
Okay. It's interesting, though. I mean, the fact that they figure these things out.
Yeah.
Now, you've done a lot of penetration testing on Windows and other operating systems, I'm assuming.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see buffer overruns and integer overflows and all that stuff still existing, or did we pretty much eradicate them because of our tooling?
Yeah, well, there, I would say there's a huge group of people in the work working on it, but in comparison, obviously, to the previous operating systems, this is happening less often.
Sure.
So there are many protection mechanisms. It depends on application that you're running. For example, if we are discussing the Internet Explorer case, then it's definitely getting more and more secure. Compare IE10 with Internet Explorer 6. That's a different version, different architecture underneath and so on. So that's something that is less happening, obviously.
I think it's...
And it's hard to overuse it, sorry to interrupt you, during the penetration test.
Okay.
I was going to say, it's the old story, you know, keep the operating system up to date, keep it patched, 64-bit, use encryption. it's pretty secure. I think there's still vulnerabilities in applications. That's where the general issues that we've had as a business. But I think as an operating system, not so much now.
Understood. So in terms of, you mentioned, so do you test applications?
Yes.
Yeah. And so let's talk about that. I can see how, applications of general purpose can be written by anyone, whatever. There's APIs. Assuming there's no bugs in the APIs, but in how the developers are implementing some solution, they're not managing their memory correctly, for example, and there's a buffer overrun when you run this app and you get into it.
A lot of incompatible applications and so on, yeah.
So are you seeing better engineering now that more people think about security up front, or is there still a lot of education required?
Yeah. Definitely a lot of education required.
Sure.
I'm always asking before my sessions who is a developer and who is not, so that I can set up the relationship. Developers are always a little bit one step behind, because they need to learn the new technology to be able to write applications. And sorry for developers, but that's what I see in the client's infrastructure. There are applications that are not compatible. And sometimes whenever people do not know the new technology, for example, standard user analyzer, to adjust your application to be more compatible with our world that we live in, then it causes a lot of problems regarding security, because they put this application on the operating system that is not supported anymore. Unbelievable is how often I see, for example, empty 4.0s in the infrastructure. That's when I see it, I'm really happy person, because my job is done.
Oh, man.
I got a great story for you. I was speaking with the developer yesterday, and I actually asked him that question. I says, are you finding your applications are more secure? And he says, well, I write apps. I write apps for a number of different platforms, which I won't mention.
Okay.
And he says, if I was an unscrupulous developer, I have an application that basically you click onto it, that you accept my terms and conditions, and it uploads all your contacts to the cloud. And he says, actually, it uploads them all to me. So he says, I've actually got all the contact information for 150,000 people. And he says, if I wasn't scrupulous, I could just easily sell that. And these people don't realize what they're actually clicking on when they buy these third-party or free apps out there.
That's why you said
so
education.
There are potential dangers that, we get the technology, and it's the old story, so security is often the second thing that we think about.
True. And that goes back to education. I mean, if you get a degree in computer science, how many security classes are you taking? Exactly. And so developers are not thinking about writing secure code, although I think it's getting better.
Depends in what kind of team you are. There are people that are responsible for security in applications, so that's, I would say, kind of solves the problem.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's a small company that is writing some app, then there is a huge chance that, I don't know, they maybe just
I mean, it's okay if it's Microsoft and you guys are following a model, which you do, so everything, piece of code that you come out, you would hope that it is secure. But the problem is, if you open up a platform, for example, the Windows Phone platform with apps, how do you know that those developers are following your guidelines and your model?
Well, in some sense, you have to run your source code through a set of tools before you can actually upload them to the store. So when you think about Android and Apple and Microsoft devices and their stores, there's sort of a process you have to go through. I think Android's probably a little more wide open as far as what you run on your phone. But it still has a similar kind of concept.
Yes.
You'd hope that somebody wrote an app like you had suggested, it would never make it to the store.
Sure.
Because we
base it a lot on trust. We trust them.
Absolutely. And I don't think an app that stole information from your machine would pass our analysis tests.
No.
But that said, it's a very, very interesting point.
It wasn't a Windows app.
Yeah, I mean, so if you think about WinRT, for example, Windows 8, it's a sandbox environment. I mean, you start trying to do rogue things on the system, you're done. They're going to cut you off. I mean, that's by design.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's not exploitable.
No.
I don't know. And it's not a challenge. So I'll put this hood on and my shades. I don't have my shades. So it's not a challenge. Question. With the growing trend of consumerization of BYOD, how do you organizations protect themselves while still allowing users to bring their devices in? BYOD,
bring your own device.
Yeah.
how do you protect? It's actually a really interesting question.
Yeah.
How you should protect, or how
so,
do you
so
do
let's
this?
Say you're an enterprise, and I come into work with my latest device.
Yeah. So nowadays they don't.
They don't.
Yes. You can bring whatever you want.
Yeah.
Whenever it's a military organization, well, there are some rules, and you cannot bring your phone in and so on and so on. But still, there are companies within which you need to turn off the phone whenever you are entering the building, but you may turn it on whenever you are in the building. Of course, it's against the rules. So it's really hard to protect from the situation within which you bring something in your pocket. To protect from that kind of situation, it's actually a very long discussion, but there are many technologies that are kind of protecting from connecting the devices to the network and so on. But nothing will protect you from, you know, taking a photo of the screen, right?
Exactly.
Even, it doesn't matter if it's rights management services or whatever else, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it's more about education rather than bringing your own device.
I think there seems to be two frames of mind with this. There's going back to like to Windows 7, what do? Do you allow your users to have remote access? So you get remote access, direct access, something like that. But that type of technology, you have folders. You know, you can access like network folders. So potentially, you're at the risk of copying data or databases being siphoned off.
Okay.
The other model is, do you go with the virtualization solution? So you create an abstract layer, a separate layer between the user's physical home device and your business. So the likes of AtV type technology, some kind of remote desktop environment, where the entire business environment is basically on the server. So they physically cannot cut and copy and paste between the user's device and what's in the office.
Interesting. Yeah. That makes sense. I mean,
I've got a session on it tomorrow.
So let's talk a little bit about that before you get to questions. I mean, you guys you're doing some really stellar sessions here. What's yours about?
I do have two sessions. First is done already, and it was called Crouching Admin Hidden Hacker, and it was about hiding and detecting traces.
Okay.
Not just only in the user mode, but I was also showing how to change things on the kernel level.
Nice.
So I was doing the kernel debugging on the virtual machine that was running. So I just connected from the other side through pipe. And I showed to users. That's the...
To users.
Yes, to users, to attendees.
To humans.
To humans.
Yes.
Users. Cool. That it's possible to change stuff whenever you're running the operating system alive, and this is how rootkits work. And I showed how to hide processes from the list, for example, as an easy example, so that something is running and it's somewhere in the memory, but whatever the tool you use, it's based on the same mechanism that operating system provides, and this mechanism, we cheated on it, so who's going to tell you what's in the memory?
Yes, exactly.
Only the tools that can get to the memory, and so on and so on. So it's getting more complicated. So this was the first session.
Okay.
And the second one is going to be tomorrow.
Yeah.
10 deadly sins, and it's about deadly mistakes committed by administrators if it's about security in their organization.
I see.
So whenever I'm doing the pen test, I see this top 10 list, and they usually guide me to get access to some passwords, accounts, and so on. Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's like misconfiguration problem.
Exactly. Lots of human, there's a big footprint of humanity in all of this. It's not just code and coders.
Yes. No.
Human behavior is huge, as you mentioned.
I'm doing a couple of sessions, one today, one again on Friday, on cryptography, called the Cryptography Chronicles.
Okay.
It was actually originally one session, but it was just so much, we decided to split it into two. And it's take somebody who's, you know, maybe you don't know much about cryptography. I'm going to take you on a journey from A to Z in cryptography. So history, development, where it's come from, and also some of the new developments in it. And we also look in depth at some of the kind of key technologies, things like AES and Diffie-Hellman, SSL, IPsec type stuff.
Great.
And I've got that BYOD session tomorrow as well.
Perfect. So, all right, so we have a couple more questions here as we wind down. This guy, I think, got mad at me before because I destroyed his name. But so I don't know what I should, I don't know, Gert, Durwas, I don't know, I don't know how to say it, man. So how do you explain identity providers to users? It's okay. The first question. We can have like 30-second answer on that.
Oh, awesome.
It's hard. We have Vittoria Bertacci here in the morning, but...
So how I would describe
How would you explain it?
When you have Friday, you go to buy yourself a beer, right?
Mm-hmm.
On Friday, people go to a pub and they, you know, have a relaxed time.
Yeah.
So whenever you ask for a beer, if you look really young, somebody will ask you, how old are you?
Yes.
And how are you going to prove it? So probably you're going to, you know, take up your passport and or your ID or whatever with the confirmation from somebody
official.
The waiter is going to believe.
Okay.
And you're going to prove your identity. So in this case, the government is our identity provider. And because the waiter trusts government and the ID that the government issues, they're going to sell you a beer.
Excellent. Excellent answer.
Unless, of course, you're 12 with a big raincoat on and... you know, trying to get into an 18 movie with a fake ID.
Yeah, or you're an analog hacker like I was back in the day when I had a fake ID.
Yeah.
All right, so how do you properly store passwords on a server database for e-commerce so passwords cannot ever be compromised?
Encryption.
Definitely. They need to be encrypted with the technology that you use. So whenever it's a database, you should use the database encryption related technology and so on. So encryption is the solution. Right?
And if it's not, then you need to look elsewhere.
Excellent. All right. So as we wind down here, I want to ask one more question, then 30 seconds each. Biggest problem in security today and tomorrow. What's top of mind in this realm that we've been discussing all day?
In terms of cryptography, we automatically assume that nobody can break it. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So we're kind of ignorant to that. You know, we think, oh, because it's secure, people sell as secure, it's always going to be secure. It's never always going to be secure. They've always been broken.
And I would say more from the technical perspective, lack of time. Because it always causes security problems. Whenever you don't have time, you just misconfigure things, you skip things, and so on. And this causes more technical problems.
Excellent. Well, hey, thank you for spending time.
Thank you.
And doing this.
Pleasure.
You're great sports.
Thanks.
And best of luck for the rest of the show.
Thank you very much.
And keep on keeping us safe.
Thanks.
Cheers.